Judge Jessen, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The matter before the court is A-20-0573, Stephen Lee Middlestat versus William H. Henney.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's October 8th, 2020, and this is the first of three oral arguments on our calendar this morning. I'll just go through some of the basic rules, which we'll find are very similar to those in our physical courtroom. Each party will have 15 minutes for argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to take it. I ask each of you when you begin your arguments to identify yourself on the record, because we do preserve these oral recordings on our website for the public. And finally, you'll notice that there is a lock on a computer in one of the screens, so that will help us all keep track of the time as we go along. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Chuck Lloyd, and I represent the appellant Stephen Middlestat in Iron Range Repair and Storage. The case before the court is a consolidation of four separate actions that were tried to conclusion up in St. Louis County before Judge Pagliacetti. Unfortunately, there were legal errors layered over factual errors, compounding things to the extent that reversal is absolutely required in this case. Now, I understand I have identified more issues than I typically would in an appeal, and certainly more than I can cover in 15 minutes. And so I'm going to start with the fiduciary issues and the damages associated with the fiduciary issues. I'm happy to discuss any of the issues that your honors may want me to discuss in the alternative. But the damages issues relative to the fiduciary issues encompass a lot of the errors that we have identified. And I want to start with, as an overview, what the damage standard is for fiduciary breach. The Supreme Court and this court have both been absolutely clear that what the damages are not sort of the contract expectation damages that you simply put the beneficiary back into the position that they would have been had there not been a fiduciary breach.
Counsel, if I may, I know that you want to talk about the damages, but I'd actually like to start with that. Overall, what are the elements of the fiduciary claim? And here I'd like to look at the fiduciary claim against Mr. Henney, against an attorney, which were, as you know, dismissed on partial summary judgment. Now, as I read our case law, when a breach of fiduciary duty is against an attorney, that has the same elements as a legal malpractice claim. That's our PADCO decision, which came down in 1989. So when we're talking about kind of, is there a duty? Is there a breach? Did that cause damages? Shouldn't we be looking at this, at least as far as Mr. Henney, through a legal malpractice lens?
Your Honor, I would disagree. I would disagree with that, because this is not in the nature of a judgment, et cetera, with respect to a legal practice. This was a failure to disclose, and ultimately taking advantage of the relationship that existed between Mr. Middlestat and and Mr. Henney.
But Mr. Lloyd, I mean, even going back, because I went back and looked at your complaint, and you're talking about rules 1.7 and 1.8 of the Code of Professional Conduct. And you're saying that his duty to disclose is premised upon his fiduciary relationship as an attorney. So aren't we looking at the elements of a legal malpractice claim? That's my first question. And if so, isn't the fact that there wasn't a affidavit pursuant to 544.42 dispositive of that claim?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I don't believe that the 540, the statute was intended to cover a situation where an attorney acts with dishonesty and fails. This isn't a situation in which there is a question about, did the attorney breach the standard of care? This is almost a res ipsa loquitur situation where the attorney is representing two clients without disclosing the fact that he is in fact actually the other client on the other side of the case. So this is more akin to a fiduciary, the standard fiduciary case, like a financial analyst or any other fiduciary that would exist in dealing with beneficiaries.
Counsel, can you, just following up, can you cite us to any case law to support your position that we wouldn't treat this similar to a legal malpractice claim?
Well, Your Honor, the again, in terms of, there's nothing, I can't cite a case as I stand here right now. The court did not decide the issue based on the legal malpractice issue, but the court found in terms of on the summary judgment motion was that there was an attorney-client relationship. I mean, that there were facts that support that. Right. And I would point out, Your Honor, that at trial, finding a fact 20, the court actually did find there was an attorney-client relationship. So ultimately, that was proven. There were also disputed, he said that there were disputed facts about whether Mr. Henney disclosed his involvement in this transaction. Those are the prima facie elements of a breach of fiduciary duty case. And at that point, the case should go forward to trial.
So, Mr. Lloyd, would you agree with me that if this was pled as a legal malpractice case, that there would have needed to be an expert disclosure pursuant to 544.42? Would you agree with that?
Your Honor, in this instance, I would say no, because this is outside of the scope of Mr. Henney's representation of the client. If the breach of fiduciary duty was related to his carrying forth of, in the representation of the litigation that he was representing Mr. Mittelstadt in, if we were alleging that beyond that we were trying to get around the legal malpractice issue by alleging that he also breached a fiduciary duty in that representation, then yes, I would agree that that statute would apply. But here, what we have is a fiduciary who is now acting outside of the scope of the representation that is still acting, still in the fiduciary capacity. And case after case says that that still has the requirements. He still has to make the disclosures, and that it would be a very strange set of circumstances, Your Honor, that an attorney somehow has more protection than any other fiduciary in terms of requirements with respect to disclosure and their liability, simply by the nature of the fact that they're being an attorney. Now, I agree that when we're talking about the attorney's judgment in terms of a representation, that that would require there to be an affidavit to justify the breach of fiduciary duty claim. But that's
so,
not—
Mr. Lloyd, if I may, I read your complaint against Mr. Henney to say, well, it wasn't that he was that he shouldn't have been representing kind of a business interest kind of while he was currently representing your client, that was a violation of Rule 1.7. Isn't that part of your complaint?
That's part of it, but far from the entirety of it, Your Honor. The fact that he failed to disclose his involvement in this transaction, that he was an owner, he was not merely the attorney for both sides, which is what Mittelstadt believed was the case, but that he was actually a party to the transaction. That was never disclosed. And as a consequence, then when you add into it, then there was property that was transferred to him, to his entity that he owned, for no consideration by the deed. There was money that was sent to this organization or paid to Maxim Management and paid to the bank without Mittelstadt understanding that his lawyer was going to benefit from that. That is an outright breach of fiduciary duty for which the court does not require an expert affidavit to say that shouldn't happen. That's the whole point of the expert affidavit, is to protect lawyers from vexatious claims. This is far from a vexatious claim. This is right in the middle of the road for a breach of fiduciary duty claim. And that's those are the cases that we rely on, the Kolstad case, the Risvold case. Those things make it clear that the attorney has got a duty to make the disclosure. And
if I may, one quick question, because I do know that one of your first arguments is the argument on party presentation, that the district court shouldn't have reached any issue beyond whether or not there was a dispute of fact about whether Mr. Henney was a fiduciary. Okay. But you would agree, wouldn't you, that this expert affidavit issue was raised on summary judgment. So that would be appropriately before us. I just want to make sure I understand.
Your Honor, it was raised. It was never addressed by the district court. And as a consequence, and it hasn't been presented in terms of an issue by the respondents here, I don't believe, in terms of a basis for why the district court should be affirmed.
We can, on de novo review, would you agree? And I just want to make sure I understand your position on this. We can reach that issue in looking at the appropriateness of the partial summary judgment here.
I would agree, Your Honor, that you can reach it. I still disagree with Your Honor's suggestion that it has any application in this setting with respect to this particular claim. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm going to ask you to circle back to the same perhaps topic, because we're referring to the judge's finding that there's a factual dispute as to the attorney-client relationship. So you get the impression the court, in fact, had the attorney-client relationship in mind, which then circles us back to this question of the legal malpractice. If somehow we're outside of that realm, what factually, if not the attorney-client relationship, creates the fiduciary obligation?
That's the only item, Your Honor, that we rely on for asserting the fiduciary relationship is the attorney-client relationship. And I think the facts are overwhelming that there is an attorney-client relationship here.
Do you believe it was error for the court to disregard then the legal malpractice issue in analyzing the summary judgment?
Absolutely not, because as I've indicated, it doesn't have any application here. There is nothing that the court requires any expert review of this setting. I'm not sure what an expert would say with respect to this, that in reviewing the facts, Mr. Henney shouldn't have taken advantage of the attorney-client relationship. That necessarily goes without saying. It is, again, this is not a situation where you need an expert to establish what the standard of care is relative to a lawyer. The standard of care in this setting, because it's not a situation where Mr. Henney was going into court and making arguments that were perhaps not in his client's best interest. And so you argue that there was a breach of his fiduciary duty because there was a conflict and he was arguing, making arguments that were against the best interest. There you would well need an expert to say that was in violation of the standard of care that lawyers owe to their clients. When you are talking about an outside business deal where the attorney is hiding, and that's the other issue, hiding his involvement in the relationship, no expert affidavit is required to hold the attorney liable in that setting. It's because it's not a malpractice claim. There is no aspect of malpractice in that setting. It is entirely fiduciary duty in that case. It's like if an attorney steals money from a client, an expert affidavit is not required to say that the client has a cause of action against the attorney. I can't imagine that a court would require an expert affidavit in that setting. So in my remaining 30 seconds here, what I want to address is one issue that goes to the fiduciary breach with respect to John Prosser, and that's finding 42 that Stephen Mittelstaedt breached his fiduciary duty to Prosser. There is absolutely no evidence of that, and the respondents don't make the argument anywhere to the district court or to your honors that Mittelstaedt breached his fiduciary duty.
So if I may, Mr. Lloyd, and I know I'm going to take us, this question will take us a little past your time, but what's the harm to your client of that finding, even if it was wrong, since the district court found that there were no damages proven on the fiduciary breach?
The court, that's the second argument with respect to this, Your Honor, is that the court was wrong about there being no damages. So, and that's the finding of fact 11 and 12, I think it's 12 or 13. We provided the court with all of the exhibits, and we've provided a summary to the district court, and we provided a summary to this court, which is addendum 5. It is a summary of every exhibit that identifies the damages in the breach of fiduciary duty case. It relies nothing on testimony. It is entirely documentation that came from Prosser's files. It's just the data and the math that establishes the damages.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. I'll turn to the panel. Do either of you have additional questions at this time? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll have an additional time for rebuttal. Mr. Henney.
Well, good morning. May it please the court. I'm William Henney. I represent the respondents. Just a brief factual review. Maxim Management is owned by John Prosser and me. It owns 50 acres of real property in St. Louis County, Minnesota, and that property is improved with a home and several commercial buildings. The entire property was leased to Appellant Mittelstaedt's company, and Appellant Mittelstaedt guaranteed that lease. They defaulted, so in May of 2017, Maxim initiated an eviction proceeding. Pursuant to the district court order, rent monies were escrowed with the court, and the tenants were allowed to stay, and the rents then were eventually dispersed pursuant to the judge's final order. Now, appellants and Prosser Holdings were involved in a series of approximately 32 truck transactions where they bought, repaired, and sold large trucks. That became the primary focus of the
two. Mr. Kinney, if I may.
Yes.
I think the panel is familiar with the facts of this case, and I did want to follow up with you on some of the questions that we have for Mr. Lloyd.
Sure.
First of all, just as far as the fiduciary duty claim that was made against you that was dismissed on partial summary judgment, because I don't believe you addressed this in your brief, but maybe you did below. Should we be looking at this breach of fiduciary duty claim, you know, as having the same elements of a legal malpractice claim?
You know, I think they're so similar. I think the analysis would include both of those types of claims, malpractice and breach of fiduciary duty. And I actually raised that in our summary judgment motion that was successful. But the facts that Mr. Lloyd completely ignores is that during the relevant time period as set forth in the appellant's complaint, and the relevant time period was April and May of 2015, clearly Mittelstaedt was represented by attorney Mike Herman, and I attached as exhibits my email exchanges with Mike Herman.
But Mr. Henning, if we were going to look at this, I mean, I suppose that would go to the issue of causation you know, whether there was a breach that caused the damages that are being talked about here. And, you know, he was signing this in, Mr. Middlesett was signing the lease, as I understand it, in your office. I don't believe, but correct me if I'm wrong, his attorney was present. He says you're representing him in other ongoing litigation. Why wouldn't those factual disputes, I understand, on factual issues about causation, why wouldn't that be enough to get to a jury if we're looking at this through the lens of, you know, the elements of a legal malpractice action?
Well, Judge Gigliosetti said, and I agree, that there were no genuine issues of material fact. Look, Your Honor, they've never established an attorney-client relationship. I did represent a company that Mr. Middlestead was involved with. It was called Wide Open Services. At the time, it was run by a different gentleman. That case had nothing to do with the case before the court today. The Secretary of State website showed that I was president or chief manager of Maxim Management. The deed that Middlestead and his wife signed showed that I drafted it, that Maxim Management would have the tax statement sent to us, and that my address was the same as Maxim Management.
I've attached. Also, just to clarify, I thought you said that the district court on summary judgment concluded that there weren't any factual issues in dispute, but I'm looking at the court's order, and I think the court found that there was sufficient evidence to create a factual question regarding whether or not there was an attorney-client relationship between defendant Haney and plaintiffs. But then the court went on to find that that plaintiffs' damage claim was related only to preserving the option to buy in the option to buy, and that was included in the first lease, so there wasn't a factual basis for the claim against defendant Haney. So I think the district court did find a factual dispute as to representation, but not as to damages.
Well, I think the key issue here for summary judgment or the standard is there were no genuine issues of material facts. With respect to the option to purchase, which Judge Pagliacetti pointed out, Mr. Middlestead admitted under oath at a testimony in trial that he didn't read documents before he signed them. It was clear in the lease, the second lease that he signed, that there was no option to purchase. And Middlestead admitted under oath at the trial that he couldn't afford it, the option to purchase, and he had filed bankruptcy recently and couldn't get the credit to complete a purchase anyway. So Judge Pagliacetti was correct in that there was never any damages asserted or proved.
What about the piece of property that appellant owned outright that was transferred to, I forget, was it transferred to Maxim? Was appellant represented at that point?
Yes.
Does the record reflect regarding that?
Yes, he was represented by the same attorney, this Mike Herman, and that deed occurred in April and the lease was signed in May of 2015 during the time that Middlestead and his then wife were represented by Mike Herman. And we provided the trial court with the emails between Herman and myself and actually the invoices that Herman had submitted to Middlestead and his girlfriend showing that they had consultations and meetings about these issues of the lease and the deed.
Can you clarify one other point for me? The option to buy in the first lease, it looks to me like Exhibit A includes that piece of property that was transferred by Mr. Middlestead directly to Maxim. Is that correct? As well as the properties that were purchased from the bank?
Yes. Both leases included all five parcels. Four parcels were purchased by Maxim from the bank, and the fifth parcel is the parcel that Middlestead and his wife transferred to Maxim, all as part of the agreement that Maxim had to buy the property and then to lease it to Middlestead.
So appellant argues that there was no consideration for that transfer of the property that he owned outright, and that made it an unfair dealing. Can you respond to that argument?
Well, the consideration, and again, the deed to Maxim happened before Maxim purchased the property from Beacon Bank and before Maxim leased it to Middlestead. And so that was all part of an agreement that if Middlestead deeded the property to Maxim, Maxim would buy the property from the bank and lease it to Middlestead and his company. That was all part of the agreement. And my conversations and emails with Herman reflected that.
Mr. Henney, going back to my questions with my conversation with Mr. Lloyd about the expert affidavit, and you did raise this in your motion for summary judgment. Mr. Lloyd said he doesn't know what an expert would say here. That, so what would an expert affidavit, what issues, I'm not asking you to give opinions, but what issues would an expert be addressing in their affidavit if one was required? That a regular, ordinary jury couldn't already comprehend on their own?
Good question. So appellants would have to establish an attorney-client relationship. They haven't done that. They'd have to assert or establish, or the expert that they never got would have to describe the malpractice. There was never an affidavit on that.
So I'm asking, so in describing them, you said describing the malpractice, what would an expert have to go through and do to address whether there was or wasn't malpractice? So whether there was any of those acts constituting negligence under, what would he be saying that a normal jury couldn't understand?
Well, there was never a negligence claim,
Okay, and so maybe I'll ask my question in a different way. If we treat the elements of the fiduciary duty claim against an attorney the same as the elements of legal malpractice, then we need to look at, was there that attorney-client relationship? And then second, were there acts constituting negligence or breach of contract that caused damages, right? We would agree those are the basic elements.
Yes.
And so typically we would have an expert talk about whether or not there were negligence, looking at the code, looking at other standards, correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And so I'm asking you is, can you be more specific about what that expert disclosure should be saying, looking at the rules and all, that a normal jury couldn't understand on their own here?
That a normal jury could not understand?
Right, because I'm looking at our case law that says, look, in legal malpractice cases, it's only the rare exceptional case that doesn't need an expert disclosure. Mr. Lloyd's saying this is that rare, I think this is would be if that rare or exceptional case. I'm asking you to tell us why, if you believe that's not true.
Yeah, I've never dealt with a legal malpractice case, so I'm not sure I have all the elements. I know that it was raised with Judge Pagliacetti in my summary judgment motion, and he sorted it out, I thought, pretty accurately. I'm sorry I can't directly answer your question because I'm just not familiar with a legal malpractice claim.
Have you looked at rules 1.7 and 1.8 of the professional rules that was referenced in Mr. Lloyd's in the complaint filed by the appellants here?
Yeah, yes, I have. Yes. And Your Honor, the only evidence that they've ever presented on this claim against me for breach of fiduciary duty is simply Middlestead's testimony that I represented him or he thought I represented him. That's the only evidence that they've ever brought into this case. But yet, Mr. Lloyd claims that I was hiding something. And that's simply not the case. I can give you 5 or 6 or 7 different examples of how nothing was hidden. And they produced no evidence other than Middlestead's testimony. And I want to remind the court, there were just 3 or 4 or 5 paragraphs in their complaint. that talked about the fiduciary claim against me, and it was only for this very limited period of time, April and May of 2015. And again, that's exactly the time frame when I had conversations with Mike Herman, who represented Middlestep. So I just don't see how they can continue on this campaign of claiming I represented Middlestep. Let me go on, unless there's a question. I think their approach to this appeal is the same as their approach to the district court complaint. They made claims like fraud and conspiracy to defraud, but they were never able to provide the facts or the evidence or even the elements. And those claims were also summarily dismissed by Judge Pagliacetti. And in addition, they brought a motion for reconsideration by the same judge. He denied that. And after the trial, they brought a motion for amended findings and a new trial, and Judge Michelle Anderson, who stepped in after Judge Pagliacetti retired, reviewed all the files and records, and she denied those post-trial motions too. So we're asking this court to affirm all the decisions of the trial court. Judge Pagliacetti had this case for 2.5 years. He reviewed dozens of pleadings, looked at hundreds of exhibits, was in court for 2 solid days of a court trial and testimony. I mean, he was very familiar with the facts of the case, and we believe made all the right decisions. Rule 8.06 doesn't require the expounding that, I'm sorry, Rule 52 doesn't require the expounding that appellants seem to think Judge Pagliacetti should have included in his findings of fact. Let me just get to my last couple of comments here. I see I'm running out of time. Like I said, we had Judge Pagliacetti for 2.5 years. We had Judge Michelle Anderson, who reviewed all of that and denied the post-trial motions. We ask that the district court's decisions in all respects be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Lloyd, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Lloyd, I think you're still muted.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right, I apologize. It's the only way I get usually shut up on these things. I want to start with the transfer of the property, the 11 or 12 acres that occurred by quitclaim deed for which there was no consideration. Mr. Henney is absolutely 100% wrong that Middlestep was represented by counsel for the transfer of that property. That transfer occurred on April 8th of 2015. The representation by Mr. Herman began in late April, about the 21st of April. You will not see any reference in Mr. Herman's emails or billings about the transfer of that property. That occurred when there was no representation. Absolutely, completely the case. And there was no consideration. It wasn't part of the transaction. It was transferred before Maxim purchased the property. If Maxim had not purchased the property from the bank, they still had the 12 acres because it had been quitclaim deeded to them. So to say that it was all part, it may have been part in their mind of that, but it was absolutely clear that what happened here was a transfer that occurred from an unrepresented individual to an entity owned by his lawyer. And it's telling that Mr. Henney can't tell the court what an expert affidavit would say relative to this transaction. It's because it is so blatantly obvious that he violated his duties under both the Code of Professional Conduct and the duties of a fiduciary. The cases that we cite in pages 23 and 24 of our brief talk about the absolute duty of candor and the absolute utmost good faith. And Mr. Henney displayed none of those things in that transaction. He simply says, I didn't represent him and we didn't provide any testimony or any evidence. But this was a summary judgment motion. Mittelstadt's testimony was enough. And if you want to talk about the trial testimony as he does is somehow bolstering the summary judgment motion, which I don't think is proper. I think it's interesting. Finding of fact 20 puts the nail in the fiduciary breach coffin for Mr. Henney because the court found he was his lawyer and found he failed to make disclosures. That's it. Now we go to damages. And the second part of the error here, Your Honors, is that the trial court shifted the burden of proof to Mittelstadt. Once the attorney-client relationship, once the fiduciary relationship is established, the burden is on Mr. Henney to prove that he was faithful to those duties.
So, Mr. Lloyd, never, that Mr. Lloyd, if I may, would you agree that if we are looking at this saying the element should be that for the fiduciary claim against a lawyer should be the same as legal malpractice, that there would not be a shifting of the burden of proof? Would you agree?
Your Honor, but the Supreme Court has made it clear that there is a shifting of the burden of proof. That is, to the extent that the court relies on jurisprudence that comes from any place other than the Supreme Court, that would be error. The burden of proof does get shifted once there is a fiduciary relationship. And those are the cases that we cited at pages 23 and 24 of our brief. So to that extent, Your Honor, that is that would be error to say that because it's a lawyer, somehow the standard becomes different. I think that is that would be incorrect statement of what the law is relative here. Now, the other thing that I want to say was the conclusion that Mr. Henney presented that Judge Paglia said he had this case for a couple of years, and so he was well familiar with everything. There's two things about that. First, Judge Paglia said he still had to make findings and conclusions based on admissible evidence at trial. And he did not do that, as we've demonstrated throughout our brief. And second, it is telling that the respondents are unable to cite to anything in the record, not one line of transcript, not one exhibit, that supports any of the challenged factual findings or conclusions of law that we have presented in this case, not one. And it goes back to that Mittelstadt fiduciary breach claim and the damages. We had exhibit upon exhibit, and that is why this case needs to be reversed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your briefing and arguments in this matter. The matter is, we take it under advisement and we'll issue a decision within 90 days. Thank you both.